Hello and welcome to Season 4 of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. We're back for a new season with 14 fantastic guests lined up ready to share their lives and insights. Plus, we've got a brand new game to play to test their Somerset knowledge to the limits. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is polar adventurer and public speaker Victoria Humphreys. As part of the first ever all-female expedition to the North Pole, Victoria went through staggering physical and mental endurance, as well as a near-death experience. Since that adventure, she's been back to the Arctic, ran marathons, climbed Kilimanjaro, and attempted other feats of stamina. We chatted through her life lessons and how she uses these to motivate and inspire the people she speaks to through her work. Victoria, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So here's an interesting fact that you know, but our listeners don't. This is actually our second podcast together, isn't it?
It is. I rather enjoyed the first one, so it was great when I got the email asking me to come on this one. And I'm hoping Somerset Stories is slightly more relaxed, I guess, than our modern perspectives, which it was quite businesslike and scary at times.
You want me to go easier on you, basically?
Yes. Yeah, all the stuff we couldn't do on that one, we can do on this one.
Yes. So we recorded a podcast earlier in the year for the company that I work for and covered quite a lot of serious and professional stuff. And it was fun.
It was, actually.
We might get into some of that a little bit later, particularly around the resilience piece and with regards to some of the work that you do with companies and coaching and that kind of thing. But we probably won't start with it.
Sounds good.
You're based in Bath, or just outside Bath.
Yes.
But you grew up in Oxfordshire, I think.
Actually, I lived in Oxfordshire for a fair bit of time, but I'm really a Shropshire girl. Shropshire, Staffordshire border is where I come from. So, and then I spent most of my holidays up in Scotland, and my grandparents had a farm up there. So, yeah, Oxfordshire was a lot of my education and my first house. So it has a place in my heart, Oxfordshire, as well.
But you're used to the farm life then?
Yes.
From your time in Scotland?
Yeah, definitely.
What was on the farm? Was it
It was mainly
cattle?
Cattle. My grandmother looked after the cows, and my grandfather looked after all the crops. So we had tatties, peas, which always stank when they harvest peas. It always smelt like a mushy pea factory. So I used to hate it. Tatties. Barley. So we spent our life in the summer. I mean, when I think about the risk assessments now, scrambling all over the grain dryer when the tractor came in, we were running around as kind of 5 and 6 year olds as he tipped the corn into the grain dryer. I mean, I don't think you'd be allowed to do it now, but we were looking back at some photos the other day, and it was childhood paradise. It really was. We just ran feral on the farm.
So it was you and how many siblings?
Two younger brothers. So I'm the bossy big sister.
You're the ringleader then?
I don't know, actually. I think the two boys, they were the nightmares, and I was the really boring, sensible one. Or I always organised them. I always used to make them do a school play, or make them go somewhere, or make them do things, you know. I think it's probably, I'm not the only person to say that. And I don't know if you're a younger or an older sibling, but if you're younger, you recognise that, being told what to do.
I'm 2 out of 4.
Okay.
So sort of in the middle, but also near the top.
Yes.
So a bit of both.
You're like a deputy head.
Something like that. Yeah.
I was always told off. So I was always told you should set the example. And I wasn't allowed to break any rules until the legal age, whereas my brothers got away with murder. So, yeah.
I think parents get slightly more lenient as they go through the children,
yes,
don't they? I remember I went out into sort of the world of nightlife in my age terms before my elder sister did.
Exactly.
And so there was a little bit of questioning as to that decision.
I rest my case. Yes.
Yeah.
It's still a bone of contention. And my youngest brother was always spoilt. He was always picked up from primary school. We were at secondary school, and he was given a bar of chocolate, and we were never given that. So, you know, I still bear a grudge.
Do you expect sort of extra birthday and Christmas presents from him now to make up for it?
Well, he seems to think it was normal, but my middle brother and I, we still complain to Mum about it. We've actually got a big family weekend this coming weekend. We're all going back up for my father's birthday, and it will come up. It comes up every time we're all together. Why did you get given a lion bar after school? So 50 years on, I can't forget it.
Did you have then a sort of different connection with, on your father's side, on your mother's side? Because sometimes, you know, when you're the only girl in a family, there's a different dynamic between different parents.
That's a really good question. Dad and I are very, very similar. So when I was being annoying and, you know, a rude teenager kind of thing, we wound each other up. But actually, we've got a very close counsel, wise wisdom relationship. He's this wonderful man who just everyone in the community, all my friends, everyone used to go to him always for advice. And I think, you know, the only daughter. And yes, I don't know my brothers, I don't know what they felt, but definitely I had that oldest child, daughter, that quite special relationship. Whereas Mum and I, we were like, not growing up so much, but when I became an adult, became like sisters and best friends rather than mother daughter. And we are unbelievably close. I mean, very, very close indeed.
Your work today focuses quite strongly on things like resilience and self-belief. Were there any events or values in your family life that contributed early on to that?
Yes, both actually. So if I take the second bit, kind of family life, absolutely. So I think if I go back a whole generation, my mother's father, he trodden a mine in the Second World War. His leg was blown off, a load of other injuries as well. So not that unusual. You know, a lot of his contemporaries had similar situations. But Mum growing up was always had this role model of someone who just, so what? Got on with everything, you know, drove tractors, ran a farm, completely behave like an able-bodied person. So she never saw I can't. She only ever saw I can. And I think that rubbed off. I mean, my father's family were not dissimilar, but didn't have the injuries. But he was brought up with a can-do attitude. So I think that double whammy, but especially my maternal grandfather, of course you can do it. You know, nothing's going to get in your way. So as children, we were always told, if you want to do something, go for it. Why not? You know, what's the worst that can happen? You might fall over, you might fall out of the tree, you might get a bit wet, a bit cold, you know, whatever it is. But just go for it, give it a go. So that was the kind of mindset we always had. And so making a mistake or failure, it wasn't a big doom and gloom thing. It was, okay, either a brief telling off or a quick reflection, but crack on and move on. So I did, to answer the first bit of your question, was there an event? Absolutely. At my school, I was head girl. And so therefore, I was obviously expected to do well. I was a role model. And I did maths, physics and chemistry because I was determined to be a woman in engineering. It was the big drive, a bit like STEM education now. It was a big drive in the late or mid 80s. And I failed massively. I got two N's and a U, which is pretty hard work. I mean, it's pretty impressive to get two N's and a U. Basically, a U is unclassified, so it's so bad they haven't even been able to mark it. And an N was, I think, under 20%. So, you know, that was a pretty big failure, pretty catastrophic failure, to be honest. But my parents, I remember getting the results. I kind of knew they're going to be bad, but not that bad. And I remember my parents, it was a Thursday, exam results still are always on Thursdays. And they said, right, you've got Friday to be upset, angry. We're going to, you know, tell you off a little bit because we're not massively happy. But by Saturday morning, we're moving on. And we're going to work out what to do next, what your future looks like. Is it education? Is it employment? What are you going to do? And that lesson, that mindset of bouncing back, getting on with it, learning lessons, reflecting, having the emotions, but bouncing back, have ever since, you know, it's that's my mantra in my life, really.
Do you remember your day of processing then? If you're given one day to do all of that, do you remember how you took it on?
Well, it's interesting because at the time it was really easy. I was still absolutely determined to, you know, I don't, maybe I'm pig-headed, bloody-minded, something like that. I was like, I'm gonna get these A-levels if it kills me. And so I was going to have a gap year and go traveling. I had a job as a teacher in Canada. So we decided very quickly I would still go out to Canada as a teacher for a year, but I would take an extra suitcase and all my books, textbooks, everything, because of course it was before laptops and computers, everything would go with me in a second suitcase. They would pay extra luggage for me. And I would study every evening. And that, whilst I'd be a teacher for most of the time in the school, the science lessons I would join in as a pupil where appropriate. And so I did that for the first 2 months. And then I discovered they were running another course in Canadian and American politics. The headmaster ran it. And I said to him, you know, could I join, even though I'm not a pupil, can I join the lessons? And it was like love at first sight. I absolutely fell in love with this politics, this political history of North America. And overnight, all those plans I'd carefully done changed. So I suppose another lesson is goalposts will always change. Don't be scared. You know, there I was set in a very clear direction of travel. And actually the goalposts change, and does it matter? No, it doesn't. So I spoke to the school in Canada and they allowed me to actually take a formal qualification like an A-level, but in Canadian A-level in this political history. And then my parents back in the UK made some phone calls to a sixth form college. Could I do 3 new A-levels in a year? They were like, yes, if she prepared to work hard. So I ditched all my physics and chemistry books and was like, yes. And came back, did my subjects in, I took, well, October to June, so about 7 months, and I got A's and B's. So a bit different. But yeah, so big lessons in changing goalposts, bouncing back, just, yeah, life lessons, really.
Do you consider yourself a natural explorer?
Absolutely not. I like wine, electric blankets, warmth, comfort. Of course, I love the challenge and all the rest of it, but no, I'm absolutely not a natural explorer at all.
So before the opportunity to go to the North Pole came about, where were you at in your life? Were you actively looking for a new challenge?
I think probably yes, but I'm not sure I knew it. I had been in my job. So after university, I did the classic graduate trainee, and I went to M&S as a graduate trainee, loved it, but I was square peg, round hole, definitely didn't, it didn't work for me. So I left quite quickly after about a year and went into recruitment up in London. So I'd been in recruitment for about 3 years. I wasn't the best because I wasn't really massively driven by sales targets, but I loved the people. I loved that interaction and looking after young people and students. So I think probably then my passions were coming through, even though I didn't know it. And I think I was getting frustrated, even though I didn't know it. And so I wasn't specifically looking for a challenge, but when I saw this advert in, I was on the tube reading the newspaper, women wanted to walk to the North Pole, I kind of knew I could do it. And it sounds really arrogant. It wasn't meant that, it's not meant to sound arrogant, but it was because I'd been brought up with this belief, well, why not? Give it a go.
As soon as you saw that, did you immediately think of your mum as well?
No, she invited herself. Definitely not. No. I rang her up to tell her about it, you know, expecting her to say, oh, darling, we'll miss you. And she said, I'm coming too. So that wasn't in my plan. Absolutely not. I did not invite her.
Her motivation was slightly different, though, right? This was sort of a more life affirmation moment.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I joke, but mum had, not long before, had had a mastectomy. She'd had a very very quick diagnosis of breast cancer from when she first went to the doctor, and within a couple of weeks she'd had a mastectomy, had treatment, and she was, you know, recovering. It was a matter of weeks, months when I saw the advert and we applied. And it was her way of saying, I don't want cancer to define me. She was even less of an explorer than I am. You know, again, very outdoorsy, right mindset. She'd never had a literally never carried a rucksack in her life. So, you know, she never, and she absolutely doesn't like tents and camping. She likes her bath every night. So, yeah, no, this was out of the blue for her.
And so what was the journey from seeing the ad and being interested through to making the team to go on the expedition?
So the first selection weekend, so you applied and you had to do, you know, a paper application. And then you got invited to, there were two selection weekends. One selection weekend was in January in Dartmoor. And that was where pretty much anyone who was interested was welcome. You know, a few people were sifted out beforehand. And really at that point, they were looking, both selection weekends and about mindset. They weren't interested particularly in your physical fitness, because you can get fit. They were interested in your mental strength. You know, if you were chucked in a river, made to cross a river fully dressed, did you whine and say, I'm cold and wet, or did you crack on? You know, each team had to carry a telegraph pole between them, you know, just to be really annoying and inconvenient. And it was, how did you cope? On the second selection weekend, any of the teams that were doing really well, they put rocks in our rucksacks to slow you down. Did you get really cross and upset and say, that's not fair? Or did you actually think, okay, that's life? And so it was how you coped with the unknown, with change, goalposts being changed, adversity. Again, it's all those skills that are absolutely vital to survive in those extreme conditions. They say it's 90% mental in the polar regions, and it is. Or probably in most adventure, it's 90% mental.
And so during those selection weekends, was there any point where the rocks in the rucksack and the sort of annoyances did make you think, maybe I don't want to do this?
No, no, not at all. And actually, at one point, we had to swim in the lake with all our kit on and stuff. And I put my feet down, and it wasn't a particularly deep lake, and I put my feet down at one point, and obviously there was broken glass, a bottle or whatever, underneath. And I stood on it and completely lacerated the sole of my foot. And they kept on saying, well, we need to stop you medically. And I was like, don't you even think about it. You know, bandage me up, but I'm not going to quit. I don't want to not get selected. But I think in retrospect, the bit that really wound me up was they, in addition to all the physical and mental stuff, they had a graphologist, so a handwriting expert down there. They wanted to, I think, instead of psychometric testing, they were going to look at our handwriting. Now, my handwriting is abysmal, and it changes depending on if I'm writing neatly for a thank you letter or I'm scribbling in my notebook in a meeting. That was interpreted as she can't make decisions, she's a bit flaky, she's a bit weak. And when I found that out, I was really, really, really cross, because I nearly didn't get chosen because of that. I think it was only probably the PR element of Mum and Me that got me through. Yeah, maybe my handwriting does show I'm flaky and weak, I don't know, but I don't think I am.
How did you feel then when you made it through to the actual team?
I can remember standing when our names were read out, and they did it by first name, and I was one of the last. I think I probably was the last of V. And I remember just my heart just going, oh. But then it was sheer adrenaline and excitement. And then we were allowed to telephone. It was, again, no mobile phone, so we all used the phone at this base where we were. And we went to telephone Dad, and he was in church. It was a Sunday. So we left a message on the answer phone, you know, saying, guess what, we've been selected. And at this point, none of us thought we would get selected. And Dad didn't really want us to go, because obviously he was concerned, especially for Mum. But so we said, I'm really sorry, we have been chosen. Anyway, he got back from church, and the press release had already gone out, and the local newspaper, the Express and Star, was already waiting for him before he even got in the house to hear our message. You know, what do you think about your wife and daughter? So he was really good. He was really supportive. But you know, it is a worry for the people left behind, definitely.
How long did you have to prepare between that moment and actually setting off? And what was going through your mind as you got closer and closer to the starting date?
Oh, that was the hard bit. It was 6 months, and then that was physical training at that point and putting on weight. So the physical bit was tough. So, I mean, I hate gyms. I loathe. That's the only time in my life I've ever gone to a gym is those 6 months, and I hated every second of it. So I would try and do as much out of the gym as I could. So I was living in Putney and working in Piccadilly. So I would kind of run, or it was the days of rollerblading. I'd run or rollerblade to work, do a day's work, run or rollerblade back, then have to do 3 hours in the gym. Oh, honestly, it was just the worst. I hated it. And at that point, that was a long 6 months. And we were desperately trying to fundraise. That was really hard because nobody would sponsor us because no one believed women could do this. So trying to get sponsorship, big FTSE 100 companies were messaging us or writing to us saying, we don't think women can make this. We're not going to sponsor you. So that was really tough. And up until literally a few days beforehand, we didn't know if the expedition actually would happen. Rather than be able to focus on mentally preparing yourself, you were just constantly focused on grabbing £5 here, £5 there, £10 here, just to try and fund the trip. So that was really, really hard.
This wasn't the 1960s we're talking about. This is 1997, where everyone thought that we were all very enlightened and that there weren't gender politics. But, you know, here we are 25 years later and the division still exists.
Completely. I mean, to give you a couple of examples, it was the year before Alison Hargreaves had tried to climb K2. I think she'd got to the top of K2, but had an accident, fell, avalanche, I'm not sure which. Anyway, she was killed. She left behind two young children. So the press at the time were pretty vile and said, you know, a woman shouldn't have gone, you know, it's awful that she's left her children behind, rather than focus on actually just the grief of an accident, regardless of whether you're male or female. And so when we all kind of started to go into the press, they were saying to those of us, I mean, I didn't have children, but to some of the other members who had young children, how can you leave them? How dare you leave them? Why are you leaving them? It's not right to leave them. So yeah, there is an argument for that, but there's an argument whether you're male or female, it's irrelevant. If you were going off, that same argument should apply. But this argument was very much being tailored just because we were women. And that, you know, just like, gracious, come on, you know, get with it to the world. So I think things have changed, but those arguments are still had against some of the Olympians this summer. How could you have left your family for so long? There's pros and cons, but the point is the argument shouldn't be any different whether you're male or female. That's my point of view.
Is it right then that the sponsor ended up being McVitie's?
Yes.
That must have helped with putting the weight on.
Oh gosh, yes. And for the partners left behind. So McVitie's wanted, yeah, classic PR, the first penguins at the North Pole. And of course, penguins are South Pole based. So McVitie's penguin, you know, very clever, whoever came up with it, very good marketing. So first penguins at the North Pole, but each family was given a humongous box of penguin biscuits beforehand as a present. Now, I'm really sorry, McVitie's, but I hated penguins before. I hated them when I was growing up. They were the one chocolate biscuit I didn't like. I hate them even more now. But my father had the most wonderful time. He just literally, and he's a chocoholic, he lived off penguins for days and weeks and weeks. And then we also, in our rations, we had penguins, so we had to eat them. We had no choice. But yeah, it was great. And they were the most brilliant sponsor. And I'm not just saying that. You know, they really were. They were really supportive. And they just made it fun, and they just a massive relief when they came on board.
The added benefit, I suppose, for keeping morale up is that the penguins had, the wrappers had jokes on them.
No, see what done? Yes, they do. But when you're at base camp, you have to get rid of all your rubbish beforehand because of weight and also obviously the environment. But in those days, the focus wasn't on the environment as much as it is now. But so you had to, you spent days and days at base camp taking every bit of food out of its wrappers and putting them into just one big stuff sack each day. So you had your chocolate biscuits, your shortbreads, your salami, your cheese, butter, an enormous amount of butter. Each person had to eat a packet a day. So to give you the calories. But yeah, so you, but no, so all the jokes went. That was very sad.
So your time in the Arctic, talk me through the highlights and lowlights, I suppose, of the expedition from your perspective.
The highlights are quite kind of broad, almost quite top level. It was just the sheer beauty, privilege, excitement. Oh my goodness, oh wow, I can't believe I'm doing this. All those emotions. You just cannot describe the feeling when the aeroplane drops you on the ice and then disappears off. You know, you are in the middle of nowhere with pretty much nobody further north than you. You are 2.5 miles above the ocean bed. You're 18 hours from base camp, which does not have a proper hospital. So you do not want to be ill up there. So you really are in the middle of nowhere. And so one hand, you've got complete and utter fear, thinking, oh my God, I hope nothing happens. But far greater is this just sense of wonderment and joy. And I just can't, it's impossible to put into words the beauty and the awe. I mean, talk about the word awe, you know, A-W-E. It really was awe and wonder up there. So that, I think, is the high spots. And obviously there were moments when you giggled, you joked, someone tripped over, you laughed, you know, those kind of silly team moments. But I think the bit I remember is just that amazing stuff. And then the downside, the boredom, because you walk for hours and hours and hours every day. And it's not like you're going on a walk with your mates and you're gossiping. You are single file. The cold. It was flipping freezing at times, you know, minus 20, 30, 40 plus wind chill factor. The hard work, the relentlessness of it, that, you know, day in, day out was the same. And you had to get yourself up every morning and think, oh, I've got to walk for another 10 hours today. I'm going to be cold, uncomfortable. I'm going to be scared because the ice is always moving. It's not flat. People think the Arctic is flat and white and you just ski across this flat surface. It's absolutely not. It's constantly moving. You've got pressure ridges. So that's, well, if I go backwards, you've got leads, which is open bits of water that appear as quickly as I click my finger, a bit of water can open up. Or when those two bits of ice crash together again, they form something called a pressure ridge, which can be 10, 20, 30, 40 foot high up in the air, and you've got to try and climb over it. So the ice is always moving, and the extreme low point was at one point the ice quite literally opened up underneath Mum and I, and we fell in the Arctic, and it carried on opening up. So we were left swimming in the Arctic trying to survive for almost 10 minutes, and to this day, we are extremely lucky that we did survive. You know, I don't think we were supposed to still be here. So that was the ultimate low. But actually, bizarrely, or probably not that bizarrely, a few hours later, when we were in the tent talking about the accident, trying to relay it to base camp over the radio, their complete lack of comprehension of what we had just gone through resulted in us just being in fits of giggles, because they just were like, oh, you had a bit of a problem, did you? Now can you do this, this and this? And we were like, I don't think you realized what's just happened. And you know, we were crying with laughter, which was obviously in retrospect adrenaline. You know, it wasn't a funny situation at all, it was adrenaline. But that took a long time to build our confidence back up again after the accident. It was pretty horrible.
What sort of techniques did you use then to start building that confidence up and, you know, to keep going once you'd been through something like that?
To be honest, it wasn't technique. It was quite simply, you have two choices. You choice to live, choice to die, choice to keep going, choice to sit down. You know, in all elements of our life, doesn't matter what problem is in front of us, you've always got two choices. If you're lucky, you may have more, but you've always got a I can, I can't, basically type choice. And that is where the selection weekends came in. It was who had that mindset to think, you know, that's not to say we weren't scared. We didn't want, of course we wanted to sit down and go home. Of course you wanted to cry. You know, we had all those emotions, but we had a stronger emotion, which was to keep going. And the strongest emotion won out. And that's the difference. So we weren't trained in it. It was in our DNA. But don't get me wrong, it wasn't easy. You know, you wanted to curl up in a ball and just cry.
The other element, I suppose, that does play a part in that is the team dynamic and the amount of trust and respect and support, I suppose, that you each give each other. So I imagine that would have been hugely important for a time like that.
Yeah. And I think you say trust. I think trust is probably the key dynamic, the key trait of a team that's successful. So obviously it's about supporting each other and all the other elements, but that trust and trust to be not just trust that someone will do the right thing, but actually trust in that I trust you that I'm going to be vulnerable and I'm going to say I'm feeling scared, weak, unhappy. Because if you don't trust your teammates, you put on a front and therefore you are hiding what could be a medical problem, a mental problem, a physical problem. So trust is also about being open and honest and showing your vulnerabilities. Definitely for the week or so after the accident, there were days when I was absolutely at rock bottom, and the team knew or sensed whether it was a leave Victoria alone, laugh at Victoria, or as my mother did, well, it was your bloody fault you put us here. So, you know, the kind of old fashioned, you know, get on with it kind of love. So, but you learned to be open and honest with each other. And I think that was the most important bit, definitely.
Can you describe your feelings, the events, the sort of circumstances as you were leading up to the expedition coming to its completion?
Yeah, it's a really weird one, that, because the expedition, going right back to getting the funding, the original plan for the expedition was to be one team of women to walk the whole 650 miles. But because we couldn't get sponsorship, because women aren't capable of walking 650 miles, we had to change the goalposts and we became a relay. So each team of women would walk for 3 to 4 weeks, walk 100 to 150 miles. Obviously, women were capable of walking a short distance, not a long distance, says I with a bitter smile. So anyway, when we finished our leg of the expedition, we were the middle leg. And we'd obviously had a pretty tough time. And, you know, our guide said, well, you got value for money, didn't you? You had a hell of an adventure. When you first radioed into the base camp to say, yep, we found a suitable spot for an aeroplane to come and pick us up, you're like, yes, I'm going home. I'm going to see my father. I'm going to see the dogs. I'm going to see, you know, my boyfriend, all those kind of things you think about. But then the moment the aeroplane arrives, your emotions flip just like that. And it's like, I don't want to stop. I don't want to play a part in a team. I want to be the only team who does this. Of course I can do it. It's dead easy. It's not that difficult. We've had the hardest bit. It can't be any worse further on. You know, all those emotions go through your mind. And that was really hard. And at the time, you don't really process it. It's only over the years that I've processed it. When every time people say to me, are you upset you didn't stand at the pole? Of course I am. Yeah, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't. But actually, in the grand scheme of things, it's no different to in a 4x100 relay in the Olympics. You know, the press saying to the first person, are you sad that it wasn't you who got your head and chest over the line first? Well, no, because everyone's played their part. And as my mother says, actually, the bit of ice we were on, the ice moves so much that the ice we were on was probably at the North Pole the day before anyway. So, you know, our bit of ice has definitely been there. So the emotions were really mixed, if I'm honest. And that's, I can still feel those emotions very, very clearly, of jealousy, if I'm honest, that they were going to, you know, two teams on were going to be the last one. Relief that I'm off and I'm going to a nice warm bed and a glass of wine. Sadness, determination I'd go back. So all those things, I can absolutely feel them as if it was yesterday.
How then, after all of those really tough physical and mental exertion, coming back to normal life, I suppose, how was that feeling?
When we first got back, it was all great excitement because we were famous, we were on television, the news. You know, when the day the final team got there, I spent my whole day at the BBC just on every single news programme live, being interviewed, you know, by the main presenters. I mean, it was just ridiculously exciting and amazing. Front page of newspapers, Downing Street, you know, just nowadays we would have been on social media and depending on our age groups, we would have probably been on I'm a Celebrity and all those kind of Love Island and God knows what else. But it was a very different world then. So you had this kind of wonderfully exciting time. But then, and you also had the immediate emotions of, wow, I can eat food that tastes nice. Smell, but there's no smell up in the Arctic apart from yourself, which isn't very nice after that long on the ice. You know, there is no smell up there. So all those senses were supercharged. But actually, you start to reassess life. So as I said, I'd been working in recruitment and I was like, actually, no. While I was up on the ice, I was thinking, which bit of recruitment do I like and what do I really love? And I love children. I love education. And so I retrained. I left my job very soon after and I retrained as a primary school teacher and moved to Oxfordshire. And so, yeah, the emotions, what is getting back to normal? Have I ever got back to normal? Is it like we say now with COVID, you know, is it a new normal? I never went back to the old Victoria. I was definitely a different person when I came back, definitely.
The new Victoria then, or the post-Arctic Victoria, is someone who got a bit of a bug, I suppose, for exploration and endurance, because after that expedition, there was no stopping you, was there?
No. So the Arctic, definitely, yes. So I went back up twice. So the following year, one of the girls who was on the final leg, she and I went back up to the Arctic and we were hoping the following year, so 2 years after, to do the whole 650 miles. So this, the 1997 was the big expedition. 98, we went back up and did a training expedition and we were planning to go back up in 99. But our sponsors fell through and she then went on one of the round the world sailing races. So I spent my millennium in the low Arctic having a fab time with a whole bunch of people. And every time, all from six people all around the world. And each time our millenniums came, we had another bottle of champagne. It was a pretty memorable way to celebrate the millennia. So I haven't been back to the Arctic since, unfortunately. But I have that, I think that self-belief around, yeah. So you asked at the very beginning, am I an explorer? Absolutely not. Am I an endurance athlete? Absolutely not. But can I run marathons? Can I push myself to my limits? Yes. I will be the last person. I guarantee I'll always be the last. So the one thing I would never do is go on SAS, Who Dares Wins, or whatever it's called, with Ant Middleton up in Scotland. I'm watching it at the moment. It would be my worst nightmare because I am so slow. You know, they'd be constantly screaming at me. So if I'm allowed to do something in my own time, I can run marathons till the cows come home. And, you know, last year I woke up one morning and thought, I'm going to go and do a 22-mile run without any training. I'm not particularly fit and I'm, you know, could do with losing a few pounds. But I just did it at my own pace. So I suppose that's what I'm trying to say is I've learnt my limits, and my limits are slowness and don't try and compete against anybody else. And enjoy it and just go at your own pace, whether it be climbing Kilimanjaro, running a marathon, you know, doing silly challenges, it's not about pitting yourself against social media and the rest of the world. It's pitting yourself against yourself. And that's what drives me. I will never be first at anything. I never have been, ever in my life, I don't think, ever. I'm competitive, but against myself, I'm never going to be first. So that's how I've changed. That's the new Victoria.
As part of that, what can you tell me about the 50 at 50 challenge? Or challenges?
So challenges, yes. So I decided, partly I was getting boring as I approached 50. You know, I'd got into career, mother, et cetera, and I always need something to work towards. I like a goal. I like a challenge. And so I thought, let's do 50 challenges to celebrate being 50 and let's raise money, you know, at the same time. But the point, the key bit of these challenges, they're not all allowed to be things on my bucket list because that isn't a challenge. You know, so climbing Kilimanjaro, that's been on my bucket list since I was quite literally 4 or 5. I've always wanted to climb Kilimanjaro. So that's a challenge, but that falls into the easy category because it's in my comfort zone. It may be difficult, but it's in my comfort zone. The difficult challenges, and that's the crux of this project, is things that I have no desire to do and I run away from. That's what I've got to do. So two of the examples, and actually someone listening might be able to help. So two of the examples I've been challenged to do and I want to run away, but I'm not allowed to. One of them is to pose nude for a life class, and I'm not body confident at all. So I'm just like, oh my goodness. And the other one is to stand up and do a comedy, 5-minute comedy sketch thing in a comedy club. And I'm so not funny. I can perform. I speak to hundreds and hundreds of people regularly, but I can't, I'm not funny. I can't tell jokes. So that literally makes me feel sick. It quite literally makes me feel sick at the thought of it. But that's what this is all about, is doing stuff that is out of your comfort zone. And I think, you know, I think we've all learned in this last 18 months, we can all do stuff that's different. We can all try things. We can all step out of our comfort zone. And, you know, I'm quite enjoying it, actually. You know, I'm dreading some of the things, really dreading them. But the more people I tell, the more I can't back out.
How many are you down to now then?
I've done about 25 or 26 I've completed. COVID has slightly scuppered me. It was supposed to be all done in 2 years, but A, COVID, B, I was made redundant. So a lot of that kind of stability and planning in my life went out the window. So I've, again, it's the thing I've said a couple of times now, changed the goalposts, and it's 50 while I'm 50. So, I mean, I've got to finish them before I'm 60. Otherwise, I'll be made to do 60 or something. So, yeah. So I'll easily finish them by then.
You mentioned before that you've spent time as a teacher and your passion for education. One of the things that I know is really important to you is the fact that actually when you look at how we educate children and young people, it is more academic and less around some of the things that you've realized are important in life around resilience, around self-belief and around confidence. So what's your take on the impact of not having that as part of a curriculum for people as they grow from children into young adults?
Yeah, I think it is so important. And I think if the last 2 years have taught us anything, it's how resilience is really important. And I'm not dismissing the importance of academia at all. I'm completely not. You know, I've been a teacher, I've worked as an education provider, I've worked for an exam board. So education has been my life for 25 years. So I'm not opposing academics and GCSEs, A-levels, university, whatever. What I am object to, actually, is this kind of linear education progression that we are expected to achieve. It's slightly, the world is changing a little bit. So, you know, you go to primary school, you go to secondary school. To be a success, you must get really good GCSEs, you then must get good A-levels, you then must go to university, then you will get a graduate job, you'll work for however many years, you'll progress up the career ladder, and you'll pop out the other end. Now, that doesn't allow for any type of failure. And actually, is it failure? You know, is it of me failing my my A-levels? Was that a failure? Or actually, was that a blessing in disguise? And it led me on a completely different career path to where I would have gone. And I think we need to encourage our children to do other stuff at school, not just the academia. And we all see it in the newspapers, there's less and less and less now. And I'm not just talking sport, but about the opportunity to actually try something a bit different. And for teachers, they're so focused, you know, because they have to be, on grades, league tables, that they, you know, when I was teaching, I had far more opportunity. If, you know, if a child asked something or the weather was doing something, I could just go off curriculum, go off my plans and just do something a bit different and wacky and wild. And the children probably remembered those lessons more than traditional lessons. And they may have all fallen off or fallen over or done something wrong. They'll remember those lessons more. Sports days, every child gets a rosette now or a medal now. That's not the real world. In the real world, five of us will go for a job interview, one of us will get it, the other four won't. Unless you're used to failing and picking yourself back up again, you're not going to be able to cope. And when I was running a business, I definitely would see, and it's not just the younger generation, I mean, pretend, you know, they say snowflake, I'm not so sure. I think it's broader than that. I think it's been a longer while coming, this ability to cope with change, ability to cope with knocks, ability to cope with criticism, feedback, call it what you want. I think people assume if they don't get their A-levels, if they don't get the job, if they don't get a progression, if this project doesn't work out, then it's either they've failed or it's someone else's fault. It's just life. And so I think it's really important that throughout, from the day our children are born, we stop selling perfection and we sell perspective and reality instead. And I just think that's crucial. I mean, my poor son, if he makes a mistake, he gets no sympathy. It's like, yeah, okay, right, what have you learned? Move on. And he's like, I wish you were like other mothers and were more fluffy sometimes, you know. But actually, he'll probably be more prepared for the knocks of real life.
You work as a sort of consultant. You spend time with businesses helping their decision makers go through the things they need to make decisions, to be more resilient, and to sort of look at their own processes and perspective on the world. How are you seeing that type of mentality then move from the education world to the world of business?
I think that actually it doesn't really matter what world, what sector, where you are. The lesson I give to people I work with, whether they are the leadership team, the brand new youngsters coming into the business, or anyone and everyone in between, the message I like to give people is, it's all about lived experience. For me, what I bring to the table is lived experiences. I'm not about the theory. I'm about the fact that every single person actually has fallen over, has bounced back, is resilient, but they may not know it because it may not have been pointed out to them. And it's about, hopefully by using the North Pole story as a bit of a kind of, kind of open up the mind and get the juices flowing, I can help people think about where they've experienced challenges in the past, how they can then relate that to them, to the today's world, whether it's their personal life, their business life, whether it's as a manager, looking at their staff, helping their staff to understand that. Because if you look at it from a leadership team perspective, it doesn't matter how many documents and, you know, business continuity plans or recovery plans or disaster plans, whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter how many spreadsheets you've got, if your staff don't have the mental mindset to cope when the chips are down, then spreadsheets are a complete waste of time. Because when they're suddenly faced with a critical decision, you know, and they haven't got that resilience and that ability to think, okay, I don't know how to do this, I've never done it before, but actually I've done similar things and I bounced back and I coped and I survived. You know, it's that transferable skill set. So it doesn't matter where you are in the business and whether you're looking up, down, left or right. It's about relating your lived experiences to your current day challenge. And that's what I believe. Everyone's got it, but not everyone realizes they have resilience.
Talking about bouncing back and, you know, recovering from struggles, usually the struggles are a short period of time and you get to kind of reframe everything and bounce back from that. We were talking before we started recording about how COVID and the crises that have come along with it have meant that there's a sustained period where people are having to dig deep into that resilience. What are your thoughts and what's your sort of advice for people who are still not necessarily seeing that light at the end of the tunnel, still finding it hard, thinking, well, I can't bounce back until I've hit something to bounce off?
Yeah, no, you're right. And I always say it's about the battery, you know, your power battery inside your body. Have you got enough energy? And it doesn't matter how resilient you are. It doesn't matter how many lived experiences you've got. All the stuff I've just said is a load of rubbish if your Duracell battery is empty. And so I think completely separate but absolutely related to resilience is your well-being, and also your perspective about just don't set yourself goals that are too big. Set yourself up to succeed, not to fail. So by the well-being bit, you know, everyone knows this, but it's really difficult to practice sometimes if you're not feeling positive. But it is about fresh air, exercise, sleep, good food, etc. But then putting it to the, you know, put it into perspective, don't set yourself up to fail. There's no point thinking to yourself, right, I'm going to go running every day this week because I know that's what all the books tell me I have to do and all the magazines tell me I have to do that and all these experts on the telly tell me I have to do that. You're not going to get out of bed and go running every day. It's just not happening. So instead, why not? You're not even necessarily going to go for a walk every day. Just set yourself the tiniest of goals. If you're not a walker, say, right, I'm going to walk to the end of the street and back today. Brilliant. You've got out, you've got fresh air, you've got stimulation. Tomorrow go 2 blocks, the next day go 3 blocks. You know, whatever it is that fills up your battery and support group, friends, family, whatever it is, are vital too. That's another element. But whatever it is that fills up your battery, just do a tiny bit first. Don't set yourself a massive goal. That's just not going to happen. Because then you succeed and then you get more energy from having succeeded. So then the next day do 2, the next day do 3, whatever those 2, 3 things are. And that's too often, again, I think we see on social media our mate having gone for a 5-miler or having done, you know, during lockdown, painted their whole house while they were on furlough. And the person next door is probably deeply upset about being on furlough and has actually gone the other way. And instead of being constructive and doing tons of jobs, has just lost all value and self-worth and confidence. And the more they see their neighbour painting the house, the more they go the other way. And so I think just base it on your own experience. Just focus on you. What's that one step you can do tomorrow? And then again the next day. And then again the next day.
Victoria, we're now going to play Somerset Who's Who, which is a game where I'm going to give you people with a Somerset connection and 2 possible identities, and you have to tell me which one you think is their real identity.
Mm-hmm. Bit nervous about this, but yes. I should have, you know, done a bit of reading, but I didn't, so...
Well, hopefully these people are obscure enough so you won't know and it's all purely guesswork. But you may know some of them, so who knows. So your first name is Sir Isaac Pitman. So, ooh. Was Sir Isaac Pitman A, the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1870s, or B, the inventor of shorthand writing?
I do actually know that because he was shorthand typing and stuff, because Dereham Park, which is up the road from me, I'm pretty sure is where he used to live. That's the only reason. Well, I'm going to sound like an idiot if I'm wrong.
No, you're correct.
Yes.
Sir Isaac Pipman is the inventor of shorthand writing.
Whoa. Gosh, I'm feeling... So there's a competitive instinct now, you know.
Your second name is Deborah Criddle. So was Deborah Criddle, or is Deborah Criddle, A, an MBE recipient for founding a homeless charity in Taunton, or B, a Paralympic gold medalist in equestrian?
I'm just trying to think of this summer's Olympics, and I was watching all the Paralympics. I don't think... I'm going to go with the hospice.
She's the Paralympian.
Oh, no! Was it this year, or when was it?
I don't know.
I'm going to have to look her up.
I don't have the whole thing in front of me. Name number three is Charles Marshallsay, or Marshallsay. So was Charles Marshallsay A, a Yeovil-born scholar who became a Canadian politician, or B, a pioneer of surgery under anaesthesia?
Sounds like a kind of Canadian-y name. And I'm just because the Canada link, I'm going to go with Canada.
It's correct.
Yay!
Your expertise in Canadian politics.
It's obviously clearly amazing.
Shining through.
Yes. Two out of three. Okay, I'll go with that.
All right, two left. The next name is Annie Lee Brown. So was Annie Lee Brown A, a concert cellist with the London Symphony Orchestra, or B, a suffragist and women's rights campaigner?
I'm going to follow my instinctive reaction as suffragette.
Is correct again.
Okay, good. Maybe I should be going on Mastermind, Somerset Mastermind.
All right, you're down to the last one then. So your last name is Jason Rowe. So Jason Rowe is a soul singer who recorded music under the name Jay, or a striker who scored over 50 goals for Bristol City in the 2000s.
Oh my goodness, where's my son when I need him? He knows every single fact about football. Literally every fact about football. I'm going to have to choose football, just in case.
He's a singer, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
So you didn't need to know the facts about football because he was a soul singer.
So three out of five. Well, that's
three
okay.
Three out of five is all right. Good.
It's over 50%. It's a pass.
Yeah.
Does that qualify me? Do I get a Somerset certificate or something?
I think you go into, the semi-finals.
Oh, yes. It's like Ken Bruce, isn't it? Popmaster.
Before we go, where can people find out more about you, about your explorations and the work that you're doing as well?
So two things, probably anythingispossible.co.uk is my kind of motivational speaking business resilience website. And then if anyone wants to challenge me or help me succeed at my challenges, 50@50.org.uk. So that's the number 50, the word at the number 50.org.uk. Or on LinkedIn.
Victoria, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely chatting with you again. You've been a great guest, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you. It's been fun. Really good fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories, or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.